The Edward Said Lecture is an annual event. He was an important intellectual, academic, American, Palestinian academic. He was, in fact, responsible for the creation of the post-colonial studies, which, of course, informs modern theory about what's going on in this part of history. And Dr. Yawari was the deliverer of this lecture this year. She was delivering it from occupied territory, and we'll hear what she had to say.
Thank you, everyone. And again, thank you for the invitation to speak with you all tonight. As mentioned, I am calling in from colonized Palestine, which has been surviving and resisting against settler colonial erasure for over seven decades. I know that I don't need to explain settler colonialism to all of you in Australia, but there is something important to say and highlight, and that's whilst all cases of settler colonialism have their peculiarities and different characteristics, they always follow the same pattern and logic of Indigenous erasure, and they end up copying each other's narratives and mechanisms of oppression much more than we know. And the Israeli regime is no exception to that. And it's important to mention this because one of the underpinnings of the Zionist narrative is that it's a project in Palestine, or its project in Palestine, and the Israeli state itself are exceptional. And this is a narrative that adopts notions such as, you know, the Israeli state surviving against all odds, and that the Zionist project is about a people returning to their homeland as promised by biblical scriptures, et cetera, et cetera. This is not an exceptional narrative at all. And actually, world over, settler colonialists and even bog standard colonialists have used similar language to justify colonization of Indigenous and Native land. For example, settler colonialists in West Africa in the 1800s used a biblical narrative, and they claimed that they were returning to the original land of civilization where it all first began, and that they were the rightful owners of this land. And similarly in Australia, settler colonialists used this notion of terra nullius, empty land, to claim ownership. In the 1930s, during fascist Italy's so-called pacification efforts in Libya, Mussolini sought to establish a new type of colony on appropriated Libyan land. And one of the underpinnings of this particular project was the notion that Italy was returning to Libya, which had once been under the Roman Empire. And so the Italian government built entire settler colonies prior to the arrival of these Italian settler farmers. The homes were already furnished. They built all these replica institutions of social, cultural and political life of those in Italy. And even before David Ben-Gurion said it in the 1950s in Palestine, Mussolini used the biblical metaphor of making the desert bloom to imagine the fascist revitalization of Libya. Now, of course, in Libya and in Palestine, this making the desert bloom meant the land had to be emptied of its indigenous population to make room for the settlers. And we know that most of the desert in Palestine is in the Naqab area, which is in the south. And during the 1948 Nakba, the Zionist forces expelled almost 90% of the 100,000 Bedouins that resided there to the West Bank, to Gaza, to Jordan and Egypt. And today, thousands of Bedouins who are descendants of those that survived that original ethnic cleansing in 1948 are still facing house demolitions, displacement, resettlement in permanent towns to facilitate the Israeli regime plan to domesticate the desert and reclaim it for its own settlements. So it's not only these narratives, though, that are shared among these colonial and settler colonial projects. It's also mechanisms of oppression. This year, Amnesty International came out with a report condemning the Israeli regime to be one that is committing apartheid against the Palestinian people. And it comes off the back of other similar human rights organization reports, but more importantly, it comes off the back of many Palestinian scholars activists and experts who have identified apartheid as Israel's mechanism of containment and oppression of the Palestinian people. Now, of course, apartheid is known globally for what happened in South Africa, but even in international law, the definition makes it clear that this is a system of domination that can take different shapes and forms and can have different characteristics. And even settler colonialists themselves recognize that they are not exceptional, and they look to each other to maintain the oppression of indigenous people. So, for example, the Israeli regime and the South African apartheid regime were on very friendly terms during the South Africa apartheid era. And declassified South African documents even show how the Israeli regime offered to sell South Africa nuclear weapons in the 1950s, which, of course, it denied, because the Israeli regime neither denies nor confirms that it is the only regime in the Middle East with nuclear weapons. Now, the most obvious example of cozy relations between settler colonial states is that of the US and Israel. And this, of course, is a relationship that is not only based on shared values of racism and colonialism, but also of mutual interests. It's to the US's benefit that it maintains such a strong ally in the Middle East, almost functioning like an imperial buffer. And for the Israeli regime, the literally billions of dollars in military aid also comes in pretty useful. Now, why have I talked about de-exceptionalizing the Israeli regime and the Zionist settler colonial project in a talk about imagining the future? Well, it's because I think it's vitally important that we as Palestinians and many of you as allies of the Palestinian struggle understand intimately our current condition, and that it's not so different from other conditions of oppressed and colonized people in history. And I think from these shared and similar experiences of invasion and erasure, we can begin to paint a picture of a liberated Palestinian future. But I think I've just made it sound very easy, and that's actually far from the reality. Indian novelist and writer Arundhati Roy once wrote, "Remember this, another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." Now, Roy's words are not only optimistic, they're also a very clear refusal of the unjust global reality that we live in, a reality in which the world continues on an unstoppable path of self-destruction, and where power structures that repress the majority of the Earth's population continue to be entrenched. The environment is being devastated to satiate unquenchable greed. The gap between rich and poor grows larger. Gender-based violence is a feature of daily life everywhere, and the colonial subjugation of the global South is continuous. So in this reality, it really is a remarkable feat to be able to remain optimistic and imagine a different future. And particularly speaking from Palestine, I struggle to hear the breathing of this other word that Roy writes about. Even when I shut out the deafening noise of injustice and oppression, I really struggle to hear even a whisper of this other world. But it is important for us to recognize that the inability to see beyond the present and imagine a world otherwise is not a coincidence. It's actually by design. Now, among many things, settler colonial projects control perceptions of reality that bind Indigenous and colonized people into a seemingly perpetual state of being. And this control is cemented through the building of colonial infrastructure, the establishment of colonial institutions, the obliteration of the traces of Indigenous life and land. And ultimately, it creates this facade of permanency, which situates the futures of Indigenous and colonized people within colonial borders. So in Palestine, these colonial manifestations include, for example, the ever-increasing enlargement of Israeli settlements, the incarceration of thousands, and the over seven decades long exile of more than half of our people. And this oppression in Palestine is multi-layered. You know, under settler colonialism, other power structures such as patriarchy and capitalism are intensified, keeping the majority of people oppressed and subjugated. And for its part, the Israeli regime has long sought to bolster patriarchal and capitalist structures in an effort to continuously disrupt Palestinian society. So I'll give you some examples. Israeli police often work with patriarchal clan heads in the 48 territories in order to sort of solve intra-communal issues. And these practices have often left women at risk and vulnerable to those that cause them harm, and it's only increased their marginalization from society. The Israeli regime forces also use gendered violence to deter women from resistance and political activism. In both these ways, they entrench patriarchy within Palestinian communities. Now, the Israeli regime has also used racial capitalist mechanisms to oppress Palestinians. For example, Palestinian workers from the West Bank are funneled into the 48 territories as cheap and exploitable workforce. They work in very laborious and sometimes hazardous jobs for low salaries with no social protections such as insurance, etc. Meanwhile, a small group of very powerful Palestinian capitalists in the West Bank are able to exploit the situation for personal profit. And the Palestinian Authority's adoption of a strictly neoliberal economic program with its cuts to the public sector and expansion into private enterprises has exacerbated all of this. Now, these structures intersect to create a situation where the majority of Palestinians are oppressed by both colonialism, patriarchy, and capitalism.
You're on 3CR with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're listening to Dr. Yara Harari, who is delivering the Edward Said Memorial Lecture. This is the last part.
And this oppression is so deeply embedded, it's so difficult for us to imagine a future where its manifestations are not a daily reality. And even when we find the space or energy to think about a future, Palestinians are constantly told by international actors what they can and cannot expect from the future. So for the last few decades, the two-state solution was presented as the most feasible, the most rational solution by the international community. And this was premised on the notion of two states for two people, something that dates back to the 1947 UN partition plan. Now, the Palestinian leadership had long rejected partition, always calling for the liberation of Palestine from the grips of Zionist settler colonialism. But in 1974, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, made its first nod to the solution in its 10-point program, which called for the establishment of a national authority over every part of Palestinian territory that is liberated, with the aim of completing the liberation of all Palestinian territory. In other words, they accepted that liberation might be territorially partial. Nearly two decades later, this position was formally adopted by the PLO at the Oslo Accords in what Edward Said called a Palestinian Versailles. For much of the international community, the Oslo Accords were embraced as this rational, phased peace plan that would put an end to the so-called Middle East crisis. The irony was that the Israeli regime, all the while, continued to build settlements and expand into the 1967 occupied territories during the negotiations and continued even after halting the negotiations. The Israeli illegal settlement enterprise continues to expand today, depriving Palestinians from their land and natural resources and further entrenching Israel's settler colonial role and systematic subjugation of the Palestinian people. And even with the obvious failure of the Oslo Accords to bring about a sovereign Palestinian state, the international community still touts the two-state solution as the default formula for a Palestinian future. And they're always based on these notions of feasibility and rationality. In other words, what's considered most possible and acceptable within the current circumstances. These notions are often used as an attempt to limit Palestinian imagining. And when Palestinians steer away from the future possibilities set out for them by the hegemonic narrative, they're often patronized and ignored. So considering all of this, diverting from the parameters, and imagining our liberation and a future in Palestine is understandably difficult. Yet challenging them has to be understood as a crucial part of the liberation struggle. At a conference in 2014, I believe it was, feminist scholar Angela Davis asserted this in the context of collective liberation. And she said, you have to act as if it was possible to radically transform the world. And you have to do this all the time. So in our context, this means believing that our liberation from Zionist settler colonialism is not only possible, but also inevitable. Bringing about a society in which people no longer suffer from the oppressive manifestations of capitalism, colonialism, and patriarchy requires us to redefine our national liberation struggle to one that embodies the kind of society that we want to build. And this means that our political spaces and discourses must reflect this imagined future. Imagining our liberation and incorporating it into our political movement is also where we might find joy amidst all of this despair. Italian feminist scholar Silvia Federici wrote about how important this is, this notion of joy in politics. And I want to quote something. I want to quote from something she said. She said, joyful politics is politics that changes your life for the better already in the present. This is not to deny that political engagement often involves suffering. In fact, our political involvement often is born of suffering. But the joy is knowing and deciding that we can do something about it. It is recognizing that we share our pain with other people. It is feeling the solidarity of those around us. And so whilst the future will always be uncertain, we have to create better and more joyful spaces among one another today so that we can begin to imagine the outlines of a better world. Crucially, we can no longer accept that the Palestinian struggle to be free of settler colonial oppression is isolated from the Palestinian people's struggle to be free from other forces of oppression. Our liberation movement has to be one that tackles all forms of oppression and envisions a society that is equal and just for all. But we also have to recognize that the Palestinian struggle is inherently tied to other global and international struggles against oppression in whatever form that might be. And I think in the last decade or so, Palestinians are rebuilding connections that were once taken for granted. If we look back to the 1960s and 1970s, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, had primarily modeled its agenda, its goals and its tactics on the Algerian Front for Liberation, for National Liberation, which triumphed over French settlers. The PLO identified similar structures of invasion and sought camaraderie and expertise from Algerian leaders, as did Black Panthers and other revolutionaries from Latin America. Amilcar Cabral, the Pan-African revolutionary, once said, "Muslims make the pilgrimage to Mecca, Christians to the Vatican, and the national liberation movements to Algiers." And indeed, after liberation from French settler colonialism, Algeria opened its doors to revolutionaries around the world. And this was a period that really embodied the spirit of internationalism. And importantly, anti-colonial struggle was at the heart of it. From Latin America to North Africa to East Asia, we saw revolutionaries, fighters, leaders donning the Palestinian keffiyeh in a nod to solidarity, but also shared struggle. Now, a lot has happened since then. Revolutionary connections have since weakened, especially with the onset of neoliberalism and policies of de-development, which have insisted on depoliticization of civil societies and the grassroots. But also the strength of narratives can't be underestimated. The war on terror that dominated the 2000s and how that demonized the Palestinian struggle for liberation, as well as wreaking havoc and destruction all over the wider Middle East. And the more recent weaponization of anti-Semitism, which among many things has seen the character assassination of political leaders who support the Palestinian struggle, like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. In Palestine itself, the internationalist politics that once dominated the scene up until the First Intifada dissipated, and we saw a deliberate process of depoliticization and the breaking of these internationalist ties. What eventually happened was that the Palestinian leadership shifted its discourse and policies from liberation and anti-colonial struggle to that of state building in the West Bank and Gaza. Among many things, this also meant that Palestine was shrunk down now not only to the West Bank and Gaza, but also only to certain parts of those occupied territories. In the West Bank, we're talking about these tiny Area A's, Bantustans, essentially. But amidst all of this doom and gloom, if we look back to this past decade, I think we have seen a revitalization of this internationalist politics I outlined in the 60s and 70s. It's a politics that insists that Palestine is part of the progressive political package, that it has a natural place in progressive and radical organizing against imperialism, against capitalism, against climate change, and that you can't be feminist and not support the Palestinian liberation struggle. It's a politics that is not allowing Palestine to be the exception in socialist or in leftist spaces, because many of the culprits that are oppressing Palestinians are similarly oppressing others around the world. The arms and security companies are perfect examples of that. So the framing of Palestine as part of an internationalist and radical package is important, not just for allies, but also for Palestinians. And there has to be a real reckoning with the internal domestic forces that help and exasperate our colonial condition. And very specifically, I'm talking about capitalist and patriarchal structures, which have moved us away from collectivism towards individualism and personal gain, which is really the perfect situation for any colonial entity, because the colonized become susceptible to corruption and collaboration and divisions within their own society. It serves the Israeli settler colonial regime very well to keep the Palestinian working classes, women and other marginalized groups doubly oppressed. And so I think here I'll end by saying that Palestine matters for the liberation of all of us, and liberation elsewhere matters for Palestine. Every colonial, capitalist and fascist regime toppled is a win for Palestine. And Palestinian liberation in itself is a win for humanity and a win for justice.